Before we get going, a big, big thank you to all of you who listened to our podcast last week, heard our request for feedback and reviewed us. You've made a hardworking team of inquirers very happy. If you haven't already and you're a fan of The Inquiry or you're listening for the first time today and you want to rate or review us, please go ahead. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts from. And now, time for this week's show. When Gulwali was just 12 years old, he left home and never went back. It wasn't his choice, but his mother's. She wanted to protect him from the war in Afghanistan. In a few weeks, they thought he'd be in Europe. But things didn't turn out that way. It took him months to get to Greece, in the backs of lorries, through time in prison, on trains and on boats. And when he finally arrived, he disappeared. He's not the only child to disappear after arriving in Europe. There are thousands of others. The EU's police intelligence unit, Europol, thinks that around 10,000 children are missing. But that number could be far higher. So, with the help of Gulwali himself, who you'll hear from later in this programme, we'll be asking, why are there 10,000 children missing in Europe?
Part 1. Invisible.
I think what shocked me most was as you would get out of the car, you would really have a very strong smell, something between garbage and blood.
Our first expert witness, Delphine Morales. She's talking about her visit to one of the refugee camps in Greece. Thousands of children live there, alongside mice and rats.
And so we were also asked not to touch children in these specific camps because they had certain diseases that were not exactly cleared yet.
She was there with the organisation she runs, the Belgium-based Missing Children Europe. They've been trying to find out what's happened to all these missing children. And to answer that, you have to go to the last place those children were seen. And for many of them, that's Greece.
And there are different circumstances on how and why these children arrive. Some of them would have been sent by their parents, hoping that the child would have a better chance at life. Some of these children have been separated from their parents on the way by traffickers, by smugglers, as a way to control them. Some of them would have lost their parents in the chaos.
And tell us then about the profile of these children. Where are they coming from? Where are they trying to get to? Are they girls, boys?
In 2015, because that's the best data that we have currently, we would see that 91% of the children that had arrived unaccompanied were male, and that 51% of these children came from Afghanistan. And we do see more and more girls arriving as well.
As well as Afghanistan, they're coming from Iraq, Syria and Eritrea. Most of them are around 15, 16 years old. But every year, younger and younger children are going missing.
When we look at recent data, we see that 42% was below 15 years old. And the EU Fundamental Rights Agency, for instance, also reported in March that the proportion of young unaccompanied children under the age of 12 has increased in Greece.
In 2014, the youngest child they had on record as going missing was 7. Last year, for the first time, children as young as 4 went missing. Take a moment to think about that. You probably know a 4-year-old. Imagine them travelling thousands of miles on their own without their parents or brothers and sisters.
It's clear that these unaccompanied children are really very vulnerable.
So what's happened then to all these missing children? Well, no one really knows. Because when a child from Syria goes missing in Greece or Italy, nothing much happens. One day they're there, registered with a border agency, but then they never show up again. And that's it. End of story. Then there are those who go missing in other countries, further inside Europe.
Just to give you some examples, in Sweden we have some reports that 7 to 8 children go missing a week. In Germany, we've had data of up to 8,900 children that have gone missing, of which close to 890 are below 13 years old. There is no complete picture because there is no efficient reporting, but we do know that many of these children go missing very quickly upon arrival.
By quickly, she means within hours of arriving somewhere. In some countries, the majority of children who went missing disappeared within the first 48 hours. It's why they're worried about one thing in particular, trafficking.
There has been some increase in crossover between smuggling and trafficking, where basically smugglers are becoming more entrepreneurial and are also exploiting the children that they were bringing into Europe.
Smugglers are generally paid by the child's family to get them where they want to go. But it seems that increasingly they're deciding they can make more money by handing children over to people traffickers, people who might push children into prostitution or slavery.
And that for us is really worrying as well, in the sense that often these are the people that these children trust. So they will rather turn to the people that got them into Europe than to the authorities.
The question is why? Why do these children trust people smugglers more than the lawyers, police and border agency officials they meet along the way? And since it's clear that not all the children are being trafficked, what's happening to the rest of them? Once they arrive in Greece, where do they go?
Part 2. Alone.
Well, I actually spent much of my childhood in the mountains of eastern Afghanistan with my grandparents as a shepherd.
That's Gulwali Pasale, the boy we told you about at the start of this programme. Like many of the unaccompanied children who arrive in Europe, he's from Afghanistan. And we're going to tell you his story in some detail because it sheds light on why so many children are disappearing when they arrive in Greece. It all begins in eastern Afghanistan.
It was a beautiful place. Actually, life was good.
But in 2001, when Gulwali was six, the US invaded Afghanistan. They were on the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and that hunt brought the war to Gulwali's village.
We were quite close to where Osama bin Laden was based, near Tora Bora, so we were experiencing more bombardments and attacks than anywhere else in Afghanistan.
Gulwali remembers going to a bunker every night with his family in case the bombs got too close. And a few years later, things got even worse. The Taliban came knocking for him.
They said, "You have no other choice but to join us."
By then, he was 12. Some of the other men in his family had already been killed. Now his mother was worried about him too, that he'd either be killed by an American bomb or killed by the Taliban for not joining them. So one day, his mother came to him.
And she said, "Well, I'm sending you away. I don't want to bury another of my loved ones, and you guys are leaving."
So he left, along with his older brother. His mum didn't want Gulwali travelling alone. They got as far as the airport in Pakistan. And then, in a moment Gulwali still remembers vividly, his brother was taken on ahead of him, and he was held back. When he got on the plane, he realised they'd been separated.
I got really upset. I got really emotional. I got angry. I cried. And then I was like, OK, what am I supposed to do? I just had to stay quiet and trying to get on with it.
It's something that agents and people smugglers do a lot. Break up siblings or parents and children so that they have more control over them. Now Gulwali was on his own, and his journey had only just begun. He flew to Iran, then travelled on to Turkey.
Crossing borders, walking for days on end.
He hid in the backs of lorries, jumped out of moving trains, and finally made it to Bulgaria, where he was arrested, sent back to Turkey and put in prison for 2 weeks.
The journey was back and forth. It was not a straightforward journey. It was like snakes and ladders.
After he came out, he was driven to the coast, where he and a group of others waited for a boat.
And then we were taken on a smaller boat to the bigger boat. The bigger boat was not really big. It was probably fit for 20 people. There were 120 of us in it. And they told us we would be in Greece within 4 hours, and it took us 48 to 50 hours. And this was, for me, the first time to see the sea.
So you didn't know how to swim?
Of course not. And I was terrified. And then the boat broke down. And here I had this discussion with God. When I saw that I was going to die, I said to God, "I don't want to die here, not like this, not now, not here. Dying in the middle of the Mediterranean, my mom will never know whether I'm dead or alive."
Minutes before the boat sank, the Coast Guard found them and took them to Greece.
And people received us with so much hospitality. And after almost a week of no food and water. The Greek people brought us a lot of food and water. It was really beautiful.
Still makes you feel emotional now to remember that.
It does.
He'd made it. Or at least that's what he thought. He was handed over to the police, then the army. His fingerprints were taken. And then he was given the devastating news. He'd have to leave within a month or be deported. And here's the extraordinary thing. At no point does he remember anyone asking him where he'd come from, why he was there, or whether he was there to claim asylum. All he knew was that if he didn't leave Greece, he'd be sent back to Afghanistan. By then he'd found out his brother was in Britain. And like any other 12-year-old boy, he just wanted to find him. And so that's when he did what thousands of other children have done. He left the refugee camp in Greece and disappeared.
We would walk through the railway lines so the police wouldn't see us. We'd be walking in forests to avoid detections. We kept a very low profile. We would not go out.
Others he knew went further to avoid being caught. They burnt their fingertips or cut them off entirely so that if they were found, they couldn't be identified and sent back home. After Greece, he went to Italy, where he was put in a children's home. And for a week or two, things were okay.
But there were issues around language. They could not find a translator for me. We couldn't really understand each other's well.
He felt isolated, trapped. And so he disappeared again, jumping out of a third-floor window.
And then I realised, the day I jumped from the children's home, I realised that it was my 13th birthday.
He'd been on the road for almost a year. After a few more weeks, he made it to Calais in France. He was there for a month, trying again and again to make it to Britain. One time he burnt his face when hiding in a lorry transporting chemicals. Then one morning, he got lucky. He hid in a lorry carrying bananas and made it into the UK. First to a detention centre, then to immigration services.
And I was questioned for hours and hours.
And what kinds of questions were you asked?
Asking about my family, my background, my journey, why I left, how I left, and some minor details about my life. And then later on that caused me problems because there were times I have not said everything that I've said in the first interview. And then they will say, well, basically, your credibility is under question. And they're like, well, I was too tired. I just get out of a lorry, spend a year on the journey all alone, you know.
And remember, he was still a child, just 13 years old. It took Alwali 5 years to get refugee status. He started school, went to university, and last year wrote a book about his journey. And so Gawali's now back in the system. Once missing, now he's been found. But there are thousands of others who never get to this point. And if their experiences are anything like Gawali's, you can see why. They feel safer disappearing than going through Europe's asylum system. So what's gone wrong?
Part 3. Failed.
Well, I suppose the system as it is written down in European legislation is actually pretty okay.
That's Kira Smith. She worked for the UN's refugee agency for a number of years and now teaches refugee law at the University of Ireland. She's been looking into how unaccompanied children are dealt with when they arrive in Europe. And what she's noticed is that there's a massive difference between what's meant to happen under EU law and what actually does happen. Let's take Gulwali's story then. What should happen when children like him arrive in Greece?
First of all, they're meant to be identified as unaccompanied. The EU has developed these hotspots now in certain locations in Greece and Italy, and there's a number of EU agencies that are supposed to be identifying asylum seekers.
And the reality?
Actually, what's happening in the hotspots at the moment is that they're turning into detention centres and unaccompanied minors are getting stuck because the reception capacity on the mainland is exhausted. And when people are festering in camps, including unaccompanied minors, they're not going to tolerate that forever.
It's why children like Gawali decide to disappear. And it's not only in Greece or Italy that it's hard to enter the asylum system.
There's some evidence that some states effectively discourage them from applying for asylum because they effectively want them to move on.
How would they do that?
By not registering them, for example, or by when they turn up to be registered saying, oh yes, come back in 2 weeks' time. This is allegedly what has happened in Belgium in the past. Come back in 2 weeks' time. It's not clear what they're meant to do in those 2 weeks. Where are they meant to go and live? Who's meant to look after them? And there's evidence of many countries along the transit route to Northern Europe adopting a kind of a wave-through approach where they're turning a blind eye to unaccompanied minors and not registering them. They're effectively encouraging them to keep going.
And they keep going because, like Gowali, they're often looking for brothers or sisters or parents. And here too, there's a gap between what should happen and what is happening. Under the so-called Dublin regulation, when a child is first registered in a country, the authorities there should find out whether they have family in another EU state. If they do, the child should be sent there to have their asylum claim processed. But again, that's not happening.
We've set up a system where it's possible for an asylum seeker within Europe to reunite with a family member, but we've made it so difficult for them that they actually can't avail of that system. So we're pushing them into the hands of smugglers.
Of course, some children do eventually make it to a country where they have relatives and where they might want to claim asylum. And here's what's meant to happen then.
They're meant to be given a representative, you could call it a guardian, and that person is meant to act in their best interests across asylum processing and everything.
But
in reality, there's massive variations. So in some countries, they have reasonably good guardianship system. In other countries, there's practically none.
And that guardian matters, because going through the asylum process isn't easy. Remember, these children, these 6, 8, 12 or 15-year-olds, are completely on their own. When their asylum claims are being processed, they often have to undergo grueling physical tests, teeth x-rays, head measurements or bone density exams to check they're not lying about their age. Then they have to explain why they left home. They'll be interviewed again and again and asked to recount in intricate detail the traumas they've escaped from.
And of course, very often unaccompanied minors don't know why they've been sent away. They might not have a very clear recollection of events, particularly if it's taken them a long time to get here. And then it's very difficult for them to give a kind of a linear account, a linear narrative. And successful asylum claims are all about being able to present a coherent story. And if there's any inconsistencies in your story, you will be accused of being incoherent and incredible.
And at that point, more children disappear. So why are there 10,000 children missing in Europe? As we've heard, once children register in Greece or Italy, there's little incentive to stay within the system. They feel safer under the radar. There are laws and regulations in place to protect them. They're just not being followed. And it's partly about numbers. Last year, almost 90,000 unaccompanied children arrived in Europe. That's a huge number for the authorities to keep track of, at a time when most European countries are cutting budgets. But it's also about people across Europe turning a blind eye to these children. People including us.
Part 4. Ignored.
I'm Dr. Farida Viz. I'm based at the University of Sheffield and I'm the director of the Visual Social Media Lab.
Farida Viz spends a lot of time looking at photos. So apparently do we. When she started the Visual Social Media Lab 2 years back, people around the world were sharing around 500 million images every day.
And more recently this summer, that figure has gone up to more than 4 billion image shares every day.
It's a lot of sharing. Evidence, she says, that we're increasingly using photos to understand the world around us. And sometimes a photo can change the way we think. She and her team have been looking at something that happened last year. It started with a photograph taken back in September 2015.
This is an image that, even if you are not on Twitter, I so far have not met anybody who has not seen that image.
The photo shows a 3-year-old boy in a red t-shirt and blue shorts, lying face down on a beach. His head is semi-submerged in the sea, his arms down by his sides. His name was Alan Kurdi, and he was from Syria. The day before, he'd been in a boat with his mother and brother. It capsized and they'd all drowned.
A toddler. He was lying here in the surf.
Aylan Kurdi.
In the space of 12 hours from the point of that image first being shared, it had been shared across 20 million screens. People were tweeting at the rate of 53,000 tweets per hour.
And it is one photo in particular this noon that is bringing the issue to the forefront.
And we do want to warn you, we're going to show you that picture that a lot of people find disturbing. It is heartbreaking to look at.
There are images where all of a sudden the complexities of a situation are reduced into a single image, and all of a sudden people realize, you know, this is no longer something that can be ignored.
It wasn't the first moving photograph of a child refugee. Around a third of the pictures we see of refugees are of children, according to Farida Viz. But something about that picture struck a nerve. Prime ministers and presidents got to work, saying that something had to be done. News organisations devoted hours to talking about the crisis. The public suddenly cared.
One of the things that we found is that for September 2015, the search for refugee-related issues was the highest search volume in Google history for that issue.
Interest turned to activism. Newspapers which once described migrants as cockroaches were now urging people to help them.
People were opening their houses to refugees. People were donating food. People were driving to Calais. 48 hours after that image went viral, nearly 500,000 people had signed a petition putting pressure on David Cameron to accept more refugees.
And that pressure made a difference. Britain agreed to accept more refugees, as did Germany. Canada promised to resettle 25,000 Syrians. And the biggest promise of them all, European leaders agreed to share responsibility for refugees arriving in Greece and Italy. 1 year on, and most of those promises have been broken. Yet there's been little public outcry. Why? It's partly about economics. As austerity bites across Europe, people feel less sympathy for outsiders. And the alleged connection between migrants and militants hasn't helped. But Farida Viz says it's also about us, the media, and the stories we choose to tell.
I think refugees tend to be shown as the mass, as a group, as people marching through the countryside or on railway tracks who are on their way to Europe. We are not encouraged to think about them as specific individuals. And so I think it's very difficult to create empathy or understanding when the dominant representation is of masses of people.
It's why the photograph of Alan Kurdi had such an effect. One boy, one story. There have been other photos like it, but not enough to sustain the kind of public sympathy for child migrants that spurs politicians into action. So why are 10,000 children missing in Europe? It's a story about failure. The failure of European leaders to keep their promises. The failure of border authorities to follow the laws and regulations that are there to protect children. The failure of the media to tell the stories of child refugees. And the failure of all of us to care for long enough.
This edition of The Inquiry was presented by Helena Merriman. It was produced in London by Lucy Proctor and mixed by James Beard. All of our programmes are available as podcasts from the BBC website. And if you have a question for us, get in touch via the World Service Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at BBC The Inquiry.